8:47. Now, we'd normally have this morning's society segment on a Wednesday morning, but with the Inter-Korean Summit taking place this week, we wanted to squeeze in some more analysis related to that. Bradley Babson, former chairman of the DPRK Economic Forum at the US-Korea Institute at SAIS, Johns Hopkins University, former World Bank Asia specialist, has been studying extensively the subject of North Korea's economic integration. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
And we'll kind of pick up on a subject we were touching on earlier when we heard from a guest from a human rights perspective. She was expressing concern about North Korea following the China model and not addressing its human rights. But I guess the China model is more hopeful when viewed purely from an economic point of view.
Absolutely, because China's done more than any other country to support the growth of markets in North Korea. And most people in North Korea now meet their basic needs through markets, not through the state distribution system. So if you look at economic welfare as an important human right, then I think the growth of markets, which China has supported, has been a major accomplishment.
Yeah, and I know we're not going to go down that human rights avenue again, but you know, the guest that we were speaking to was obviously raising concerns about human rights abuses beyond basic needs. But as you point out, basic needs are hugely vital in themselves. How do you feel about what we're seeing this year? Are we seeing meaningful change in a more positive economic direction?
Well, I think that Kim Jong-un is clearly decided that economic development is his top priority, and he's been really pushing that since the very beginning when he talked in his first speech, New Year's speech, about not having people have to tighten their belts again. And to some extent, he's tethered his own legitimacy to delivering on a better life for his peoples, and he's been working at that by giving the cabinet a lot more responsibility for designing and implementing an economic development strategy, relying less on the military and party for that. And he's also tolerated the growth of markets and the emergence of a middle class of private entrepreneurs who are playing an increasingly important role in the economy.
So do you think that's fundamentally why we're seeing this dialogue and a seeming willingness to use this relationship with South Korea to get back on track with Washington?
Well, I think he knows that unless Washington is supportive of a more forward-looking economic development policy, that he's not going to get as far as he wants. And so responding to Washington's interests and needs, particularly as we know on the nuclear front, is really an important part of Kim's agenda, and the South Korean relationship has become a really important vehicle for trying to find a way to put those pieces together in a practical way that both allows him to pursue economic development and for the U.S. to feel that there's meaningful progress on the nuclear issue.
Despite U.S. reluctance to give any leeway on sanctions, for example, at the moment, is it still meaningful to have key decision makers from major companies like Samsung and Hyundai and LG and SK all with President Moon Jae-in on this trip?
I think it is good, and it's good because it allows these South Korean magnates who have expertise in management, they have foreign markets, they have resources, to have a face-to-face discussion with the senior economic officials in North Korea about what kind of economic development relationship would be practical and beneficial to both sides. They haven't spent a lot of time talking with each other about economic development, so their ideas that had percolated in South Korea recently, of course, most of these companies have their own task forces figuring out what they would like to do, but the North Koreans have their own ideas. So you have to start with a dialogue, and that dialogue is beginning now, and I think these officials from these companies are in listening mode as well as exploring ideas to see what might have traction. I think that's very important from the point of view of the nuclear negotiations, because the sanctions are negative leverage, but the economic opportunity is positive leverage. And I think if South Korea can help identify what kind of economic positive leverage would actually be meaningful to the North Koreans, that would actually help the negotiation process on the nuclear problem.
The thing is, SK leader Choi Tae-won, he was there in 2007 at the last Inter-Korean summit in Pyongyang, and he's there again this time around. Do we need to use that kind of comparison to think what we can do to learn to make this more significant going forward than what happened in 2007 when we then had a shift in government here, an end to the Sunshine Policy era?
Right. Well, I think the elections both in South Korea and the U.S. had a big impact on the evolution of the inter-Korean relationship, as we know, looking back in history. And there's a window of opportunity here for both President Moon and Chairman Kim to see how far they can go before you get into elections either in the U.S. or in South Korea. They have a window of another 2 years with President Trump's initial term in office. So the question is, how far can you go before the elections kick in and you might have a shift in orientation of one government or another?
Yeah, it makes sense. But I know that's an area, by the way, that you've been writing about, that, you know, it's imperative, to directly quote you, that South Korean policymakers assess the lessons of the Sunshine Policy. Does it worry you that we could still get carried away, though, that we could try to find ways around sanctions just to, you know, squeeze a little bit more out of inter-Korean cooperation, even without U.S. support?
Well, I think the mood since the earlier summits in this spring has been sort of gravitating towards relaxation of sanctions. We've seen the issue this week with the Russians, and there's been reports about relaxation on China's side and the visits to Beijing, et cetera. And South Korea's, you know, gearing up. I've just been reading about the increase in the budget for the Korean Inter-Korean Fund. There's clearly a signal that the neighborhood is ready to engage economically if the political process can move forward in a way that is meaningful. And the U.S. is still pushing, you know, hard sanctions, but I think the environment is weakening around that policy. And the question is, how do you balance the negative pressure of sanctions with the positive leverage of practical economic cooperation?
I'm curious what your answer is, but I'm also fearful of what President Trump's administration will do about it.
Well, the question is, what leverage do they have at this stage? I worry that the Security Council is not likely to be as coherent as it has been, certainly during 2016 and 17, when the rather dramatic changes in the sanctions regime were approved. That doesn't seem to be the atmosphere of the Security Council right now, with the fact that Kim has suspended tests and has made certain overtures on moving in the direction of denuclearization, talking about negotiating a way out. So the question is, where's the leverage to get other people on board a tough strategy of pressure?
Yes.
At the moment, it's hard to see.
Well, Bradley Babson, it's a realistic view, and thank you for sharing with us today everything you've got to say. We'll be watching closely this week to hear what we get from the press conference today, especially.
Yes, I think so.